Welcome back to Charge It to the Game, a Game of Thrones rewatch podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Lovegood, Luna's favorite cousin, professor of African American Nomad Studies at Ilvermorny. I'm joined by Gingy, my love, and
Hello,
TJ, my second favorite black man with a cop. Obviously,
hello, hello.
R-Truth. How are y'all today?
Good. I
Good.
want to learn some African American studies, though.
African American Nomad Studies.
I don't know what that is.
Those are Amer that's what American wizards call muggles, which are people.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. That was a mouthful. I'll tell you what, though.
I've been practicing it all week if we're gonna be honest. Like,
Prepared.
I'm very prepared this week. So this week we're going to be discussing Game of Thrones season one episode three, Lord Snow. Gingy, what did you think of this episode?
So far, it's my favorite episode.
Really? Well, I mean, out of three,
Yes,
yeah.
because it made me laugh a lot more than the other two.
Okay.
Made you laugh. Yeah, there was a lot of funny moments in it. There were some funny moments.
Okay. Where does this episode rank for you in the first season, DJ?
I think it's up there because we get a lot of information in this episode. We get a lot of good moments. Like this episode is not slow like the last one. Like this episode is it's pretty beefy.
I felt like this episode was much better paced, and it felt like the conversations were more interesting. I feel like it feels like you're getting more tea than
Yes.
the last couple episodes.
We learn a lot about some people. We get the conversations are meaningful, not just kind of there. Like they actually have some weight behind them.
All right, well, we'll go ahead and get into it. Game of Thrones, season one, episode three, Lord Snow, written by David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, directed by Ryan Kirk. It was a 2.4 million rating on May 1st, 2011, and so they ended up with a 3.1 rating, even though the West Coast airing was interrupted over the killing of Osama bin Laden.
Oh shit.
Right?
Oh, that
Okay.
was it. Yeah.
Right?
If honestly, if you were to ask me off the top of my head what year Osama got killed, I would have told you like 08. I would have told you like way before 2011. So crazy.
I know it was pretty, I was married by then, and I know the apartment I was in when John Cena announced it at
Oh my God. Yeah. Imagine getting your news from John Cena. And they say don't use Wikipedia as a source.
Right.
I'll be damned.
I mean, like, he came out there like he was on SEAL Team 6.
I believe it.
We have captured and compromised to a permanent end,
All
Osama.
right, sidebar here. Sidebar. This is nothing to do with Game of Thrones. But I remember watching wrestling. And I can remember the first time I John C saw John Cena, he was a thug. And then next thing I know, he's like Mr. America. Like, what happened?
Remember how Post Malone was a rapper and now he does country music?
Yeah.
Okay. It's kind
So
of
it's
like,
just a rebrand. Got you.
essentially. Yeah.
Because I can remember John Cena in like some Reebok pumps, like the Shaq shoes, pumping them up.
He still got like the jorts and the jerseys.
Yo, the jorts were horrible. I don't even know why they kept that shit going for so long.
Oh, he's still wearing the jorts. He wore them at WrestleMania. He was at WrestleMania.
God, man. Please tell me he's still doing the freestyles.
No, he did one.
God damn it.
The last time he did one was in 2019 at WrestleMania in New York. He came out as the Doctor of Thuganomics. It was amazing. Like I had it was a moment.
The nostalgia. The nostalgia.
It really.
All right, back to Game of Thrones. Off the WWE.
All right, so we begin in King's Landing. The Stark banners ride into the city. Ned rides in on a white horse. He looks completely uncomfortable. He's immediately greeted by someone in the castle telling them that he has to get to a small council meeting. And then he asks him if he's going to change his clothes. And the way Ned looks at him, like,
yeah, he was like, are you crazy?
Nicest thing I own. What are you talking about?
But it's crazy also, like, soon as he rides in, like, time for a meeting.
Yeah, I mean,
like, you didn't even know what these guys were. Well, he, I guess he knew their roles, but it was kind of like a quick rundown, like, super quick.
So Ned goes into the castle, and there's a shot of him as he walks into the throne room, of the Iron Throne, and then Jaime sitting in front of the, sitting at the foot of the throne, that I thought was really interesting on this rewatch. Okay. But it was like, it was a really good shot, and then Jaime immediately starts back in on his smart me bullshit.
Is this a situation of two guys just too much testosterone trying to one up each other? Because that's all. So this one didn't feel like episode one. Like, this one felt like they were both just like having a pissing contest with each other.
It doesn't feel like a pissing contest to me, because to me, a pissing contest is like he starts it and then he starts it and then he, but it's always Jaime.
Jaime starts it, yes, but Ned also participates.
Well, Ned always participates, and I think we'll find out why later.
Yeah.
But no, it's, I think this is all on Jamie's part. I think this is like Jamie's inadequacy showing, like his insecurities.
Yeah. And Jaime says some pretty good stuff in there.
Does he?
He does. So we get Jaime talking about Ned's family. So Ned's brother and Ned's father were killed in that room by the Mad King. Ned asked him, you know, why didn't you step in? And Jamie's like, there was 500 of us. Nobody did.
Nobody said anything. It was silent as a crypt in here.
And that's one of the things where, like, Jamie's right. Like, what do you say? What can you say in that moment? You're watching two guys get killed by the king. Like, who are you to say anything in that moment?
Listen, because like, it's not just like killed. It's the way they were killed, and like the book describes it in detail, and it's gruesome. It's really rough. Like, I'll get there. We'll get there, but yeah, it's pretty bad. What did you think, Genji?
I just thought it, you know, two dudes just trying to show each other up again.
He's like, let's get to some action. Let me get something cut.
That's exactly what I'm waiting for.
So we got to the small council where we meet Varys.
Before we get there, one thing that I want to point out that Jaime said, that was pretty, makes you think a little bit. He asked Ned, would he think of him different if he stabbed the king in the belly instead of the back? And I think that, you know, once we learn deeper in the series, Jamie's reasoning, like, that all makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I see what
you're... I think that's one of the, yeah, I like that. I like that question that Jaime asked. Like, this is one of the few moments in season one, because Jaime ends up being one of my favorite characters in the series as we progress. But this is one of the few times in season one where I'm like, okay, I like Jaime a little bit. Like, I can see where he's coming from. He has a point there.
He does. He does.
You're killing the king one way or another. Who cares how you killed him?
Also,
man, there's no honor in stabbing somebody in the bed.
Something else just occurred to me. So I hit you about that.
All right.
Okay. So the small council meeting, we meet Lord Varys, a messy bitch who lives for drama.
He really does.
The Master of Whispers. We meet Lord Baelish, the Master of Coin, and then Renly Baratheon, the King's brother. I don't actually remember what he is master of.
Yeah, I can't remember either.
Yeah, but Renly is also
master of baiting.
You said what? Master of what?
He's the master of baiting.
Accurate. quite accurate. Oh, goddamn. Yes, he is indeed the master of baiting. The masturbator.
So we got a little bit of background on actually Ned and Catelyn's relationship, or at least before Catelyn and Ned got married. We find out that like Peter Baelish was in a duel with Ned's brother for Catelyn, and he bears a scar from navel to collarbone because like he cut him open, and he said he was fighting for Cat. I hate him. Like, he is the top three villain in the series for me.
Me too. I hate him throughout. Like, it. God, man. He sucks. Like, he sucks so bad.
Every single watch, he gets worse and worse and worse for me. So, like, I'm especially with the podcast and everything, like, I'm interested to see exactly how much I end up hating him this time. Like, how
once we talk through it, we're going to really hate him.
Whew,
James, first impressions on Lord Baelish?
Well, I don't trust him. And the actor that plays him always plays the same type of character, where he's this slimy, backstabbing, sneaky, trying to get away with whatever he can type person. So it's like automatically like a red flag for me.
Yeah. Well, he didn't do that in Dark Knight Rises. And then you said what?
He was in Dark Knight Rises?
Yes, he is the guy on the plane at the very beginning with Bane.
Oh yeah, that's right. He's the FBI agent or yes. CIA agent or whatever. Yes. That's right, he was.
Because the only thing I know he's been in is Queer as Folk, or not. Is that what? Is that the one? I think that's it. Like, he ended up kissing, I think he ends up like making out with Jax from Sons of Anarchy.
Never seen it.
I know you've never seen it, but like, that's where I know him from.
And then he is also a good guy so far. I'm not done yet, but he's in The Wire. Super young in The Wire, too. But he is in The Wire. He plays a guy running for mayor, and he becomes the mayor of Baltimore. And it's hard to watch because, like, to me, he's freaking Littlefinger. So,
does he put on an American accent?
He does. He does.
Oh, is it better than Idris Elba's?
Because
really, I didn't realize Idris Elba was English.
Yeah. In The Wire, it's definitely better. Like, in The Wire, like, Idris is kind of putting on an American accent, but kind of not. Like, it's in between in The Wire.
It's much better on The Office.
But yeah, like, those are two things where I go back and watch, and I see him, and I'm like, damn, it's hard. It's hard to even, like, be on this guy's side.
All right, so, in our small council meeting, Ned is given his Hand of the King badge, and he finds out that King Bobby is lazy as fuck. And not only that, he wants to have a tournament while the crown is $6 million in debt, because government, of course.
And $6 million in debt to who?
Well, $3 million to the Lannisters.
About $3 million to the Lannisters, yes.
$6 million overall.
But $3 million to the Lannisters.
What's $30,000
more? Yeah, well, shit, man. Atlantis has got that band by the balls. Like,
right? I know. Our people are just starving. Who cares? But yeah, Ned seems really like really, he's very, this is very, what did I miss from Hamilton? Like, Thomas Jefferson gets back to America and immediately he's like thrust into a cabinet meeting. And there's just all this information being thrown at him, and he's trying to like process it, process being in this new place and process the fact that, like, his friend is a shitty leader. Like, worse than he actually thought.
Yeah, like, Ned is, he's got his hands full.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What did you think, James?
Kind of just seems like Ned finding out all that that the realm is 6 million. Just, I don't know. It's like same feeling we get when we hear we're sending all this money to other countries and stuff, and it's just like, what you doing? Like, what are you doing?
But you also see how much power the king has, like. Even the way they're talking about it, like, he's like,
yeah, they're like,
he's like, no, we can't do this. And he's like, oh, well, the king said we had to. Yeah, we got to do it. Comes from Robert.
Yeah, they're like, ah, yeah, who cares?
So you can tell that nobody on that small council has ever pushed back.
Especially considering, you know, like, the king's not even here for your first small council meeting. Like, he's not here to figure out, like, what's going on. He's literally just throwing you into it and saying good luck.
And do we ever get any kind of inclination that Robert is a violent king? Like, he's not the Mad King.
As far as being violent, like, toward his subjects, like a...
Yes. Like a in terms of, like, if somebody from the small council were to push back. Like, I don't think Robert's the type of king that would have them killed on the spot.
No, he's just a king with a temper.
He's just verbally abusive.
Yeah.
I mean, but...
So that's the weird part. Like, nobody's pushing back, and it doesn't seem like he would kill them for it.
But the king is the king. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, even if he doesn't kill you, you lose your position.
And that small council is all about power. So the people on the small council.
So our next scene is Cersei and Joffrey. She's cleaning his wounds and telling
his
him.
Little scabs.
Yeah, he's a warrior like his father. It's very clear that, like, Joffrey hates Sansa now.
Yep.
And Cersei once again goes into her boy mom. She's like, you have to marry her, but you can fuck whoever you want to. You can do whatever you want. Because you'll be the king. And then he starts talking about a royal army, which, truthfully, like, in the scope of things, he kind of ate that one little thing. But everything Cersei's saying to him, like, makes sense.
Yeah, he was onto something.
He really
was cooking for a little bit. he was cooking for a little bit. The biggest thing in this scene is Cersei's story. Like, you slay the dire wolf, you killed the dire wolf.
Yeah,
he's like, no, I didn't.
No, because
I didn't. And what she says,
whatever you say it is.
Yeah, she says to him, the truth is what you say. You're a king. The truth is whatever you want to say it is, whatever you want it to be. That's what the truth is.
And, the thing I took away from that whole scene was, like, that is some crazy motherly advice if I have ever heard it. Yeah, I'm sitting there watching the whole thing and I'm like, you can do what?
You can fuck do painted what? Horse.
Like, what?
Yeah.
Mom, I can do that?
And noble virgins.
Like, great day.
I also thought it was interesting when she told him everyone who isn't us is an enemy.
Yeah.
Because that's a big part of, like, who Cersei is as a character.
And it's a big part of who the Lannisters are. Like, that's Tywin. Like, this is Tywin, like, flowing through them in that scene.
There's a lot of Tywin in Cersei in a way, like, daddy, please.
But you can also tell, like, he's not only taught his kids the importance of, like, family loyalty and how important it is to be a Lannister and to keep the name going, but he's also taught them tactics. And you don't always win with might, you win with your brain as well. Like, we saw that with Tyrion. We see that here with Cersei. Like, she's very tactical in the way she approaches things. And we see that throughout the series. Like, she's very tactical in how she does things.
So then we go to the Starks in the South. Sansa and Arya, tensions are pretty high, as is expected.
Very high.
Arya Arya accuses her sister of getting Mike killed, and she's like of Joffrey of killing Micah. She's like, the Hand killed, or the Hound killed Micah. Which, you know, how is Sansa supposed to know that adult humans are going to be like, yes, kill a child? But anyways, Sansa, their Septa calls, says that Arya is acting like a beast. And as soon as she said that, I was like I went back to what you said last week about what Cersei said about Arya and how that made you feel. It's like, wow. Like, I feel like it's got, like, Cersei put a label on Arya, and I feel like Arya heard that. And, like, she's, like, running with it at this point.
Yeah. Arya's acting out in the scene. And this isn't, like, you can't really defend Arya in the scene because she is... She's being a kid. Like, she's acting out. She's mad. She's angry.
Wow.
Nah, I love it.
I actually don't mind it. It's very, like, I mean, it's very true to her relationship with Sansa, her relationship with her dad, and then also their age range. Like, this is how they act with each other. Like, it's very accurate for that. But Ned comes in, he gives Sansa a doll. She says she hasn't played with dolls since she was 8. And he tells Septa Unella, war was easier than daughters. And this is the first time I've heard that line. I had not heard that line until this watch. And I just thought it was really cute. Like, I was like, Ned was really heavy on the dad in this episode.
Yeah.
He was.
And it was heavy, like, he understands now how hard it is to raise the two girls by himself. Like, he's always had Catelyn there to help him, and now he's trying by himself. And you can see that he's a little out of touch. Like, he doesn't know that his daughter still doesn't play with dolls.
Yeah.
Like, and he's trying to find that balance and knowing what they like and then also protecting them as well.
And it's really beautiful to watch, because the next scene with Arya and Ned actually made me, like, cry for the first time. Like, I actually sort of teared up with him explaining to Arya why Sansa lied, which I shouldn't have had to do because Ned did it for me. Thank you. So,
yeah, I was thinking to myself, yeah, he sounds a lot like what I heard last week.
Yeah, because like I said, Ned said it for me, but it just made me cry because, like, Arya is just so vulnerable in this scene, and it's not... We don't get vulnerability like this out of Arya pretty much again.
Yeah.
And it was just so beautiful to see her with her dad. And like Ned sort of understanding her with Needle. And asking her, do you know the first thing about sword fighting?
Stabbing with the pointy end.
Loved it. That's one of, like, the best lines in the series.
It really
she,
is.
She just, like, literally took what John told her and said the same exact thing. And she has to keep the sword.
Yes. And, like, it...
But you can also... Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I said you can also see how differently Ned treats Arya and Sansa. Like, Ned knows that he can be more transparent with Arya because she takes it better. Like, he's telling her, like, I'll be honest with you. Like, it's dangerous here. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't a friendly place we're in.
Yeah. Like,
but he wouldn't say that to Sansa because her position's a little different. Like, he can't scare her and knowing what she's supposed to be. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, in defense of Sansa Stark, she still thinks this is a fairy tale. Thank you.
Here we go.
And
then, I think Arya's rebuttal to Ned saying, how can you let her marry someone like that, is what truly sticks out there.
Yeah, I that, like, one really got me.
How can you let your daughter marry somebody that you know is a piece of shit?
And it was like the a lot of this episode for me was in Ned's face, like in the expressions he made when people said things to him. And this was one of the ones that I pointed out, just like his face when he's like, well, and he's like, well, my like 10-year-old just pointed something, like my 11-year-old just pointed something out to me that, like, yeah, why am I doing this? I feel like, especially after that small council meeting, he's like, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
We arrive at Winterfell, where Crow lands on a ledge. Bran Stark sees it, and Old Nan tells him that not to listen. The crows are all liars. Which I thought was a really interesting line.
It was one of the lines that made me laugh.
She asked,
coming for her, it's interesting.
I love this whole scene.
Yeah, it's really cute. And then she asks him if he wants to hear a story. And she says that, you know, she knows stories about, you know, giants. And then she knows he likes stories about Sir Duncan the Tall, who is the star of the Hedge Knight. That's who the new show, The Hedge Knight. It's him and Egg, which is, that's who my baby is named after, the unlikely. Which I'm like really mad that I couldn't teach him to get an English accent down. Because like if you put a blonde wig on my kid, he could have played that like as a white kid. But anyway, Old Nan is pretty intense in this scene. Like while she's explaining really what winter means in this realm, like what winter means for the Seven Kingdoms for Westeros, she's incredibly intense.
Very detailed. And
she she did an excellent job that her acting in this part. Like I love this scene.
Yeah, she was great.
Then the music that they added with it too, and then the zooming in on her face that she's still going, like, oh my gosh, that was so good.
You didn't see any speaking going, mouth's not moving.
No, not this time.
Right. to make sure I ain't missed nothing.
This scene was so good.
It's a really good scene, and it's sort of meant to like stress to you like what winter is coming really means. Like they don't mean that they're storing up for a few months of cold. She's like, whole generations live, like were born and lived and died. Kings froze to death in their castles. Like winter is a very serious thing. And it's not to be taken lightly.
But then you start the question, how serious is the story? Because then Rob comes in and he's like, oh, what the fuck is she telling you now?
Yeah, she told me we live in the eye of a blue-eyed giant named Macumber.
So I think that's really cool how they show so much seriousness on what she's saying, but then the very next thing you see is like, oh, is this really true or not?
Yeah. Yeah. The Lord of Winterfell is just like, don't worry about it. But Rob is so beautiful in this scene. But he's a really good big brother. Like he's doing his best to step in where Ned and Catelyn have left him. As
like you know, he's taking that whole you're the man of the house thing to like heart.
He really is. So we'll head back to King's Landing.
But before we go, I think it's important to point out that Bran does learn his fate in this scene. He learns that he's never going to walk again.
Yeah, that's pretty sad.
Yeah,
and I think it's cool that Rob is the one who like confirms it for him, and Rob doesn't really like beat around the bush about it.
And so, then he's also like, "I've seen you climb 1,000 times."
Yeah, he's like, "You didn't fall." He's seen him climb in the wind, the rain, and he's never fallen. Yeah. And then Bran doesn't remember anything, so Bran's like, "Oh, I fell. Like, I had to have fallen."
But crows are all liars, so we'll see.
Crows are all liars.
So Catelyn arrives in King's Landing with Sir Roderick, and finds some guards waiting for her to take her somewhere. She's taken to one of Lord Baelish's pleasure houses.
What a slime ball.
Right? Disgusting. God, I hate
like, what a slime ball. Oh. We couldn't like meet over coffee or something. Like nobody knows who she is. She says it herself.
We could have met anywhere that's not the Red Keep. But like this was a power move on Baelish's part. But he brings out his partner in getting her there, Lord Varys, the Master of Whispers, whose little birds have told him that Catelyn would be coming. And
you can't trust anybody these days. That's what I got from that whole part.
Okay.
Don't trust nobody.
And so they bring out the dagger. Catelyn asks if Varys knows who it belongs to. He says he doesn't. Lord Baelish says that it was his until he lost it to Tyrion Lannister.
So first, Baelish's little smirk when he's talking about the knife irks me so much. Like, he's like, that's my knife.
Well, I think he gets more excited because, like, he says that he points out that, like, this is the first time he knows something that Varys doesn't.
That smirk, I just want to punch him in the face.
Him and Varys are definitely, like, two shady queens on Drag Race. They're just, like, it seems like they're constantly, like, speaking of pissing contests, although with Varys, that might be difficult.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, like, a back and forth with them, and I think Lord Baelish was just so excited to know something that Varys didn't know, especially knowing that Kat had come to King's Landing specifically to find out who that dagger belonged to and being able to tell her that Tyrion was the last person with it. So,
but it's kind of crazy how Lord Baelish and Varys are one in the same, but they're so different. Like, they are kind of the same person, but at the same time, they're so different from each other.
Because Varys is, I think it's explained a little later on.
We do get it. We learn both of their motives.
But,
we learn why they are like they are. But both of them are, like, both of them strive to always be three steps ahead.
Yeah.
Like, they always want to have the upper hand on whoever it is they are, who they're talking to, who they're with.
Yeah. And it's the why that makes them different.
Yes. The why they do it is what makes them different. But they're the same in the fact that they love being conniving. They love being just ahead of, like, wanting to feel like they're ahead of everybody, smarter than everybody. But the reason why they do it is totally different.
Right. And so, Gingy, did you get the answer to your question?
What was my question?
Last week about the dagger and why they would give it to a bum.
Oh, all right. So,
I want you to know we did it.
No. I'm confused about, all right, so, or I'm not confused, as you say, but I don't, from that, I still don't, like, why they would do it. I don't feel like it was answered. But on the scene where he says that Tyrion was the last one to have it, I feel like Tyrion wouldn't actually have given the knife to the dude.
Okay. I do think you get your answer a little bit in this scene, because this is where Lord Baelish is three steps ahead, right? Like, he understands what Catelyn's thoughts are, and his story tailors to exactly what Catelyn thinks. So whether the story is true or not, whether he lost the knight to Tyrion at the tournament on a bet, here's the better question. Why would Tyrion bet against his own brother? Like, that's the question. Because in the story, in Baelish's story, he says that he bet for Jaime Lannister to defeat the, what do they call him? The Knight of Flowers, whatever they call him.
We will meet later as well.
Yes, we meet him very soon. So he bets on Jaime. That means Tyrion bet against Jaime. Why would Tyrion bet against his own brother?
Good point.
Yeah.
So that's why, like, if you really pay attention, like, it's, you,
so what we're saying is, we're questions. Really saying is that Baelish, since he knows that she wants to blame the Lannisters for the assassination, then he is making up it to try to say that they did do it.
I mean, I think you can get that out of the scene. I won't say it whether it's that's the fact or not, but I think you can
you're getting
get that out of the scene.
You're getting warmer.
Yeah.
All right. So, anything else about that?
All I got Baelish is a liar, and I don't trust him.
Yes. Yes. A plus. So back at the wall, John is sparring in the yard with his fellow recruits. He is way better than they are, which goes to show that, like, even being a bastard, being a high, like, he's high born, so he still has privilege over all the rest of these guys coming in. It's like they don't have the training that he had. And we also meet Sir Alistair Thorne, who is intense and immediately presents himself as a hater.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. He's one of my most hated people in the series as well. I hate that motherfucker, man. Hate him.
Yeah, because he calls him Lord.
He just never respects John from the get-go. Like,
not an ounce of it.
Like, there's not an ounce of respect for this guy. And it's because he's high. It's because he's highborn. And I think it's because he's also a bastard. So, like, he's John being a bastard should not have that privilege that he had. And I think that's, like, where the lack of respect comes.
But I don't really even think that that's that. I feel like he thinks that he's, like, a show-off. Because, like, I feel like, John's just getting here and he's, what, like, 17? And he's already... Yeah. Like, how much better is he going to be? I think immediately Alistair sees him as a threat.
Because really, like, you can, based off of, like, just the things John says in the episode, you can make the assumption that he's probably the best person there, other than maybe Benjen.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah, so. he's been formally trained. But Tyrion is also speaking with Commander Mormont. And they get a note for Ned Stark's son. And Tyrion asks if it's good news or bad news. And Commander Mormont says that it is both.
And this is also the scene where Mormont's asking Tyrion to send help, right? Or is that later? That might be later in the episode, right?
That's later.
Yeah, that's towards the end. We'll get there.
So we go back to...
All right, hold on.
What's that?
Why would he say that it's bad news?
Good news that he's alive, bad news can't walk again.
Yeah.
That's my assumption out of that.
Yeah.
That note.
I mean, you can't walk again. It's not like he can get, like, an electric wheelchair. That's not an option.
I just want to make sure.
Back to Ned in King's Landing, he also gets a note from Grand Maester Pycelle, who says that he forgot, which is bullshit. Like, nobody on the small council would forget that they had a note for Ned Stark. And
I think it's funny, like, just the way Grand Maester Pycelle is. Like, well, we see it. We're going to see it eventually, but yeah, he's very funny. Like, that's a funny guy.
So Lord Baelish comes in and tells Ned that he knows where his wife is.
But it's funny the way he says it, because he's such a dickhead about it. Like, you can't like this guy because he's so slimy. He's like, oh yeah, your wife. And she's in Winterfell. Fell. Is she? And it just walks off.
And then has a little smirk on his face again.
Is she?
Ned should have snapped his neck right there. Like,
imagine saying that to somebody like Ned. Like, I'd be scared. I'd be terrified to be fucking sarcastic like that. And he's just, is she?
But again, like, I know something you don't know.
Yep.
And, like, that's...
And he loves it.
That is Baelish's, like, that's his king.
He gets off on it.
So... we go back to the wall again, where John is accosted, right? By his fellow Night's Watch recruit. And he's saved by Tyrion coming in, like, they've got a knife to his throat. And he's saved by Tyrion coming in and letting them know that he's seen all of their faces. They've already chosen this over, like, losing a hand. So the only thing from this is death. So it's, you know. obviously they scatter.
But I love this scene because Tyrion puts so much in perspective from John to John that changes John's total outlook on his time at the Night's Watch. So this scene is pivotal for John.
Where John's like, you know, they all knew what this was and nobody told me. And I feel like Benjen tried to tell him.
Yeah, Benjen tried. Everybody tried to tell him. Benjen tried to tell him. Jamie tries to tell him in Jamie's shitty way.
Yeah, but he knows better. You know,
because I mentioned that in season one, I was like, is he really being a dickhead? Is he really trying to tell him, hey, you don't want to do this?
And both things were true.
Yeah. And I think I said both. But yeah, like, I think this is like buyer's remorse on John's end. Like, he thought he knew what he was getting into, but then he's like, yeah, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah, you thought.
No refunds.
Yeah, no refunds. Sorry, it's buyer's remorse.
But Tyrion, like, because Tyrion lets him know, like, what these other guys were facing instead of coming here. He was like,
Tyrion,
because you, like, you know, obviously he chose the wall over living with Catelyn. But, you know, Pip was trying to feed a sister. And they told him that he could come to the wall or he could lose his hand. Like, that was the decision that they were facing. And, like, you chose to be here.
One of them got abandoned.
Yeah, you just
his family, like,
yeah, you have to give them some grace.
Yeah, like, these guys had no choice, no formal sword training, but John points out, hey, I'm better than them. They're just mad because I'm better. Well, no, I mean, they're mad. They're mad because you're a highborn, but they're also like,
yeah,
like, they come from nothing. Like, they've never had a sword, like Tyrion points out.
And it's also interesting that, like, once again, Tyrion is interested in people's stories.
Yes.
Like, he really is interested in the things that other people go through and what other people, why it drives them to act the way they act.
Yeah, he's very, very analytical. But it's cool to see. It's cool to see, like, Tyrion just, you start to question his motive. Like, why does he want to know all this?
Yeah. So back in King's Landing, Ned arrives at Peter Baelish's brothel, and Baelish informs him that his wife is inside, and Ned yokes him up, and, you know, Catelyn screams out the window, like, Ned, I'm up here. Ned goes up, and Catelyn fully friend zones Peter, like, in this moment once again.
It's, oh,
like,
yeah.
Brother to me.
He's a little brother to me. You know what's funny about the Ned, like, jerking up Baelish like that? Like, we see that again. Like, we see a mirror image of that. I think that's, like, I just thought about that as I watched it. Like, we're going to see that happen again. And it's pretty cool. I think that's, like, intentional that we see it. That we see it happen again. I think it's intentional we see it.
What did you think? Because, like, I wrote down, this is like the Drewski skit where the whole time Ned is staring Peter down, and like that Drewski skit where, like, it's your girl's birthday and her boy best friend comes in and he was like, you got a good girl, and the whole time, like, Drewski's getting madder and madder till he sends his long ass paragraph. Like, that's what it gave me, because, like, in this scene, Ned is so fed. Like, if he could snap Peter's neck in this moment, he absolutely would.
And I think he was on his way.
I think he might. What if?
Yeah, he was on his way until Catelyn stuck her head out the window.
You're a funny little man.
Damn it. If only she would have stayed in that room for, like, 30 more seconds. We would have been done with Baelish already.
We could have wrapped up right there.
Like, how we would have been done with him. I think every episode so far we've said something like that. Like, if only this happened, you know, this shit would have never happened. Every time.
So next is Jamie and Cersei, where she asks him, like, how could you do it? Like, he's a child. But
weird scene. Weird question.
Yes, because didn't you say, like, he's seen us? What else was he gonna do? What was he going to do?
Yeah, like, this is a weird scene. Like, she takes no accountability.
None. None.
It's all Jamie's fault that the kid, it's Jamie's fault that the kid didn't die on the fall. Like, Jamie pushed him 50 feet out of a freaking window. And the kid lived. Like, that's Jamie's fault the kid lived.
Yeah, and then Jamie tells her, he was like, I'll kill everybody until it's just you and me left. Which is a really, it's a very sexy line, but he's saying it's.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, man, I would really be like, oh, dude, nice. If it wasn't for his sister. Nope. Like, oh, yeah, kill everybody until it's just you and me. Yeah, bro, get it. And then I'm like, oh, wait.
Like, that's the thing is, like, Jamie and Cersei have some very, like, some, like, a lot of moments like that where you're like, if they were not twin brother and sister, I'd like, this would be really beautiful.
Like, the greatest love story ever told.
A lot of the drawback about them as a couple is that they're brother and sister. Like, that's mainly what I cannot get behind. I can get behind everything else they do, but I can't get behind that. So it's all a wash to me.
All right, y'all got to look past that. It's Game of Thrones. Nah, we got hundreds and hundreds of years of brother and sister marrying each other before this. They ain't the first.
I mean, true. True.
All right. So Ned says goodbye to Catelyn. She wants to see the girls, and I really wish that she had been able to see Sansa. I feel like Sansa's journey would have been a lot different had she been able to see her mother.
You know, it's kind of this scene's kind of telling in terms of how much Ned loves her when she wasn't supposed to be Ned's in the first place.
Exactly.
There's, you know, that's something to think about. Like, it's something to think about, like, how it's weird they felt so much in love when you look at how Robert and Cersei are. Like, they weren't supposed to be together, and you see how their relationship is, but then you see Ned and Catelyn, they're not supposed to be together either. But they love each other.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think,
and it's got to be kind of awkward if Catelyn was supposed to be going to Ned's brother and Ned ends up with her anyway. It's awkward anyway. But
also because his brother died.
Yeah. It's the only reason why they end up together.
But Ned says that he's going to bring the truth to Robert. And she tells him, or he tells her, to control her temper. Which I will come back to in the quote section, because there's like a really interesting connect here. But like, and then again, we get into like a close up on Ned's face as she's leaving.
Yes.
And there's just so much just pain in his face, like just agony. Like,
like you said in the beginning, we get a lot of close ups of Ned in this series, in this episode.
The way that Ned, like, you can tell what Ned's thinking from his facial expressions in every scene. Like, he really doesn't have to say much.
And I think this episode is probably mistitled. I don't think this is a Jon episode. Like, this isn't like Lord Snow. Like, this is Ned the Hand or whatever you want to call it.
Yo, agreed. I'm sitting here like watching this and I'm like, why is it called Lord Snow? Like, yeah, we show Jon at the wall, but I'm like, this episode is really not focused on Jon.
Yeah, this is a Ned episode through and through. And if you're new to the series and you're watching this for the first time, like, this is when you kind of realize, like, Ned is the main character.
Yeah.
Like, this is Ned's series.
Yeah.
Up to this point, like, this is Ned's series.
Yeah, this is why he's on the DVD box.
Sure.
So next scene, we get King Bobby talking to Ser Barristan about their first kills.
I love this scene. Love the scene.
Robert mentions that his was at the Battle of Summerhall and he killed a Tarly boy. Remember the name of and that the Tarlys were loyal to the Targaryens. And then Lancel Lannister comes in to give him his wine and he's out of wine and Robert turns into an alcoholic. Because
also remember Lancel. Just keep him in mind.
Yeah.
He's kind of pivotal through the series.
But you said this is your favorite scene. What? Let's hear it.
I love the stories. Like, I love the reminiscing in this scene. Like, because especially from Robert, like, whether Robert's drunk and he's doing this or whether Robert is just trying to get entertainment, but how detailed Robert remembers his first kill is pretty amazing. and how all of them were the first kill is pretty amazing. I think it just shows, like, and it's weird to me also that Robert's first kill was during the rebellion.
Right. That's,
so that's crazy to me anyway.
Like, you started a whole war and you've never killed someone. Like, you've never.
Never killed somebody until you started a war. What was your first kill?
I think, too, the fact that they remember their first kill so vividly makes them three people who do not take taking human life, like, lightly.
Yeah.
Like, they don't look at killing people as, like, something they do on a whim.
And these are three of the best fighters in all of Westeros that are alive. Like, these are, like, three of the top five, probably, that are living right now.
Yeah.
And all of them just remember vividly. And you think of Barristan. Like, Barristan's probably killed, like, God knows how many men he's killed at this point in his life. And he can pinpoint that first kill.
Yeah. Jinji?
I'm not surprised that they can remember the first kill. Like, that's a pretty significant milestone in somebody's life.
One, I hope I never know.
Right, exactly. I will say that the armor that Jaime was wearing is gorgeous. You know how I was.
Yeah, we know how you hate those helmets.
I hate the helmets for the people in the north, but that armor that Jaime wears.
That Kingsguard armor is pretty good.
Oh!
Now, did you notice that Barristan was wearing the same as that?
Yeah. It looks so good. But actually, I thought this this scene was, to me, like a throwaway scene. Like, I feel like it did not fit with this episode.
I know it seems that way, but there's a lot of information you've been given for the future.
Which is right, because, like, he talks about when he killed the Mad King, what did he say? And Jamie's like, oh, the same thing he was saying the whole night. Which is, like, for me, watching it, I'm like, all right, so since we know he's a Kingslayer, and that's pretty significant part right there. But, like, the rest, like, I don't know. To me, just that whole scene just didn't seem like it fit the vibe of the rest of the episode.
Well, he also introduces a group that's important because he says his first kill was a member of the Brotherhood.
Right.
An outlaw, a member of the Brotherhood. So that will come back.
Yeah, we get a lot of important names. Like, we get the Charlies, we get the Brotherhood.
Yeah, we get a lot of stuff that seems small, but it
fits. Right, and I get, like, they said, like, they gave up the names, the battles and stuff, like, and I get that. It just didn't seem like it should have been placed at that specific time in that specific episode.
Okay.
I think the placement's perfect, like, just in terms of how much information, and that's why I said at the beginning, like, this episode is a lot of information. Like, this episode is beefy. So.
So across the Narrow Sea, the Dothraki are still on their way to Vyas Dothrak. And Dany is really embracing her role as a Khaleesi of these people. And she stops the Horde to take a rest. She goes off into the field and she's followed by Viserys, who is so bitch made. Like, he's so angry that she would command him. But it's like, I'm the queen here. You married me to this guy. Like, this is what you asked for. But it's just like, he cannot stand the thought that, like, these people are not listening to him. And even though he's the Lord of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like, they give no fucks about him. Number one,
they don't give,
like, they don't care who he is. But it's also cool to see that they've accepted Daenerys as their Khaleesi, her being a foreigner.
Yeah.
So, like, you can, she has this aura at this point. Like, she has this aura of a amazing queen, an amazing leader. Like, everybody likes her. Like, they're willing to protect her because, like, they didn't have to protect her like that. And
yeah. Yo, when he threw that whip, hit him with the whip and then threw him back. Yo, I was like, I sat up, yelled, and I was like, who's the real king now, bitch?
When he yelled at Jorah to kill these Dothraki dogs, and Jorah just was just like, so anyway, Danny.
And this is where you see the shift in Jorah and who he has loyalty to, because in, you know, prior, he says to him, like, I want to serve the one true king of Westeros. and he's talking about Viserys. But you know, he looks at Daenerys when he says it. Like, we caught on to that. And then this is where you see that moment. Like, who he really has his loyalty to.
Yeah.
Loyalty.
Yeah. And Viserys and Joffrey are sort of like on equal lengths with the entitlement, the way that they act, and the inbreeding. So yeah. It's just all, yeah. But I did like Viserys. Speaking of sartorial comments, the embroidery on Viserys's tunic, the dragon embroidery, was gorgeous. Like he's, everybody else is wearing like rags and leather, and he looks like fresh. Like he's got drip.
Yeah.
In the middle of the desert. Back to John. Well, back at the wall, John sees the wall for the first time. Benjen's waiting for him there, where he tells him, like, I wanted to be here when you saw it. And it's very intimidating. Like the look down, like my intrusive thoughts would have kicked in immediately.
Yo, I would not have been able to look down off of that thing. I'm scared of heights. Like, there's no way I'd be getting up there. No way. I would have, like, lay there in a fucking ball.
But Benjen says that he's going out, and John says that he's ready. And Benjen's like, you're no ranger. Like, you just got here. You don't even, like, you haven't taken an oath. You haven't done anything. And John's just ready to run out, which is sort of a testament to who John is at this point, which is like, he's still a young man who's quick to jump to do dangerous things.
But he's also a young man who was raised in a highborn family, highborn house. So he thinks he's entitled to these things. Like, I think this is part of his upbringing. Like, because John sees himself as, like, I mean, he's born that way. So he knows that no matter what, like, for example, no matter what Robb Stark does, Robb Stark's going to be the Warden of the North. Yeah. No matter who he is as a person, how he is, he could be like Joffrey. It doesn't matter. He can fight. He doesn't have to fight. It's given to him. And it's one of those moments where John thinks it's given to him. Because John's the best fighter there, remember? So why wouldn't John be able to go out? He's the best fighter there. And Benjen tells him, and he reminds him that here at the wall, you earn everything you get. So you have to earn it first. Regardless of who you are, you have to earn it.
I think it's one thing funny is that I'm also watching the TV show Shogun. And I'm not going to give out any spoilers in case you want to watch it. Because
I do want to watch it. Don't give me spoilers.
But there's one line in this most recent episode where the leader of the clan was like, hey, why are young men always so – young men who have never seen battle so quick to rush to battle? And, like, we see it in episode 2 when Robb and the other guy are like – yo, let's go to war with the Lannisters. And now John's like, hey, let me go to the wall. Let me fight. I just thought it was pretty funny that that correlate. Because it's true. So far, all the young people in here are like, hey, let's go kill something.
But it's true as a young man anyway. Like, think about yourself as a teenager. Like, the one thing you're always trying to do as a teenager and as a young man is prove yourself. Like, we always think that we should get the things that we really haven't worked for or earned yet. At an early age, like all of us think at 20 years old that we should be making six figures, right? We should have the six-figure job in the Mercedes already at 20.
I mean,
like, it's just human nature.
I spent thousands of dollars and spent 4 years in college for a job, and you know, I'm still making $30,000 a year, so
exactly.
But at 20, like we're 18, like we're getting out of high school, and like, you know, where's my Mercedes? Where's my BMW? Where's my six-figure job? It's just who we are as humans and as men.
John's 17. He's got the hormones of a 17-year-old running through him, and he's not interested in girls. That energy's got to go somewhere. We move on to Tyrion and Yoren, sort of shooting the shit and just talking.
Shooting the shit is right. This is like two dudes like shooting the shit.
When Tyrion says something really interesting in this scene. Which is that the only difference between them is the wildlings is that when that wall went up, their ancestors happened to live on the right side of it. And I was like, huh, isn't that applicable?
Yup.
Doesn't that sound familiar?
Yeah.
But, you know, I like this scene. And also, I think that this is the scene that I have missed out because, like, the last time I watched the show all the way through was the first time I realized, like, where Yoren came from. Because, like, I had missed this whole part about Yoren saying.
Me too. Like, I saw this guy and I'm like, oh.
Okay.
Now I know. Yeah, not just you. Not just you.
Okay, I'm so happy it's not just me because I completely missed it. And I was like, oh, that's why he's okay.
He plays such a small but important part. So like he's easy to miss, like in this watch through. And if we weren't pointing this out now, I don't think James would even notice this guy again.
Yeah.
So like you'll see him, but you're gonna forget that you probably ever saw him before anyway. I'm
gonna forget where.
All right, let me make a note of that, dude.
Yeah, so now you know. But yeah, he's in this scene, like, he's hilarious, but he's very forgetful.
Yeah.
I think Benjen and Tyrion's moment's kind of funny.
The little brothers.
Yeah, and I don't. Why is Benjen such a dickhead to Tyrion?
I say it's just Starks are always so serious.
Yeah, and I think also because he's a Lannister.
Maybe. But I wonder if this has anything to do with kind of just why Benjen's at the wall anyway. Like, just his demeanor and like how he is. Like, he doesn't seem fit to be, like, in a position of power anyway. Like, he's the first Ranger, but, like, I don't know how he would do, like, in a political setting.
Right.
Kind of like everybody else is in.
But I mean,
not born in the house.
I mean, Starks aren't really made for politics.
No. Yeah, no.
Now across the Dithraki Sea, we find out that Daenerys is pregnant. We also found out that Jorah's father is a man of great honor. So, yes, that is Jorah's father at the wall, and he betrayed him. Did you catch that?
I did.
Okay. But yeah, that's Jorah's father is Commander Mormont. And it's interesting to me. Jorah looks worried when he finds out about Dany being pregnant.
He leaves.
Yep.
Immediately rides off.
We'll circle back.
We will. We'll get back to that.
When the scene first happened, I was like, wait a minute, is she pregnant already? And then I'm like, wait a minute, like months have gone by. How long is two moons in this universe?
This watch through is the first time I've given that some thought.
So is it like
I'm assuming it's two full moons.
But like, how many days are in two moons? Because like our moon cycle is 28 days, but what is theirs?
Oh yeah.
Like
I would have told you like whatever our moon cycle is, because I didn't know ours is 28 days. So there you go. Shows you didn't listen to science class or whatever class you want to put that in. Whichever class it was. I didn't listen.
Astrology girl. You would have known. Wait.
There's one thing about that scene too is when Khaleesi and Kyle are cuddling. I never would have expected him to be a cuddler. And this goes back to, I think, to what I said in the last episode in that last sex scene where I said there's a shift in power now.
But this is where I also said, like, this is where they kind of, like, that's where they fell in love. And you see it here. Like, they love each other. It's a true love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and
where they fell in love.
Also, this is where I got confused. So when I said last time that I didn't realize that girl was not Dothraki, I think I get her mixed up with this chick.
With this one who's coming to tell, like the one who.
Yeah. I think this is where I like messed up. And now I'm trying to picture in my head until we see that one girl again. The first one I said wasn't Dothraki. Like, do we ever see her? Until like season, what is that, season 3?
No, we see her. No, we continue to see her throughout this season.
Okay.
Yeah.
Throughout. I can't think of any other time I've seen her in throughout. This until like season, is it either two or three?
Yeah.
But.
So back at the wall, the first thing I have written down here is John is a natural leader.
Oh, the first thing I have written down is Tyrion pissed off the wall like he said he was.
Yep.
Tyrion did what he came to do.
I actually have a few things about this scene.
Okay.
I just thought it was a little weird. That, I mean, I'm pretty sure I know why it's done this way, but like, he's holding his penis with his hand above it while he peeing. To me, that's a little weird. I don't do that. And then another thing is that he's holding it with his right hand and then shakes John's hand with his right hand.
There was no bathroom or Germex, and you always shake with your right hand anyway, so it would have been weirder if he would have shaken John's hand with his left. So
I mean, I just wouldn't have shook his hand.
Pre-COVID, you would have.
You might be right.
Oh, man.
Man, I saw that. He shook his hand. I was like, oh, my gosh, that's the same hand he peed with.
Yeah, pre-COVID, no big deal. This is pre-COVID.
We find out that the wildlings are fleeing south and that the wall is manned by undisciplined boys and tired old men.
And we meet Aemon.
Yes, Maester Aemon.
Maester Aemon.
Is he blind?
He is.
Okay.
He's legally blind. He can't see.
But there's no resources for the wall. But they have money for a tournament. But, you know, what's $40,000 for a tournament? Those guys up there are just guarding us from what lies beyond the wall.
There's a lot of urgency. Like, they... Yeah. And this is the difference between the people at the wall and understanding what the deserter was telling. Everybody that wasn't fucking listening in the first episode, like, they listen. And I think having somebody as old as Aemon, who's seen it before, or seen winter come before, not in the sense that generational winter, but like he understands, and like the person whose house is winter is coming didn't believe this guy.
Of course not. They never do. So
in this scene, do we think that because when he's telling Tyrion this, his like facial expressions, is he starting to like actually think that these things are real and he's actually gonna go to his sister and be like, hey, they need some help up there. Like, is there a shift? Because, you know, before he went there and he don't believe any of it. And then in that scene, his face kind of makes it look like, okay, well, maybe it's not all false, made up bullcrap.
I think at this point he still doesn't believe him, but it might be like one of those things you don't want to believe.
I'm not sure if it's like he believes them. I think it's like he sees the conditions that they're living under and he realizes they do need resources. Because like whether or not there's Grumpkins and Snarks, they still want to keep the wildlings out. And the wildlings are coming south of the wall. So back at King's Landing. TJ, do you want to introduce this one? Because I feel like this is probably one of your favorite scenes in the scene, knowing you.
My guy, Cereal.
Yes.
Cereal. Yes, I love Cereal for real, man. The these are Arya's dance classes. Yeah.
And she's not a majorette.
So, you said what?
Not a majorette, but this will do.
Yeah. I do love this scene. Like, this is where Ned understands his daughter. Like, he is training her to be able to use a sword. And she's a natural. Like, she's so good already.
She's
James,
just...
what you think?
I thought that it was pretty, like, for him to... he got her a teacher to teach her how to fight, but then the teacher knows, like, this is also a child and is not a boy, so he's, like, gonna teach her how to fight, but doing it in ways that also she can understand.
But he's doing it in his way, and I think that's the key in this, is Ned didn't get her trained by somebody in King's Landing. He's getting her trained by somebody from Braavos. They fight a different way. They fight more agile.
Also, if you pay attention, Arya is ambidextrous.
Really?
I wouldn't have thought that, but I fights... just would assume that she would learn to fight like that just the way he's teaching.
When people sword fight, they don't learn with both their hands. They learn with their dominant hand. Okay. But in that fight, she switches hands and then continues to fight. To me, that's pretty significant.
I'm gonna watch.
She's definitely a natural, but I didn't pick that up. I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah. But I appreciate that input because I would have never seen it.
Yeah, she switches hands.
But I do think it's cool to see her fight that way. Yeah, it's pretty significant for her.
Yeah, I think so, because like at the beginning of the episode, you know, she's mad, then sad, you know, talking to her dad about Sansa, and then now she's like smiling. So it's like a complete turnaround for her. I like that.
Yeah, this is her escape. She's like, this is her guy.
And then Ned comes in and gets to have his proud dad moment, and we get another up on his face after Arya stabbed with a wooden sword. And
you got that proud dad, and then went straight to PTSD.
PTSD, exactly. Like, you see it, like, he is traumatized. Like, that's trauma.
Anyway. I like how they did it to where, like, at first you're hearing, you know, wooden swords clacking, and then you start hearing them become more metal, and then it just intensifies to, like, it's one-on-one metal, and then you start to hear, like, a full-out battle, kind of, with metal. So I do like how they did that. It was really cool.
So that was episode 3, Lord Snow. I don't think... We don't
have any pour one out moments. We are
keeping
the bottle full. There, nobody dies in this episode.
I think it'll be nice. Like, we should keep a tally of how many pour one out we don't have to have.
Yes. So this is number one.
Okay. This is one of, like, so few.
Yeah, it's very few.
All right.
And the whole time I'm thinking of, like, I'm watching the show, I'm like, damn, like, nobody's died yet. And then I'm thinking to myself, did I miss one? Because somebody always dies. Game of Thrones. But yeah, no, nobody died.
All right. And now for our quote segment that I like to call stick it with the pointy end. Like, we're going to put a pen in it. TJ, you want to go first?
I'll go first this time. So mine is from Jamie at the beginning of the episode. And there's not really, I don't know if there's many powerful quotes in this episode that we get. Like, it's a powerful episode, but I don't think there's any, like, really big quotes that stand out a lot. But one day he says, the king shits and the hand wipes. And we see that in this episode. Like, Robert is doing his thing, doesn't care about anything, and Ned being the hand, he's there to clean it all up. So the king shits and the hand wipes.
I love it. Gingy?
That was one of mine too.
That's funny.
Most of the ones here, like, I got a couple. And I think it was just because some of them were funny. And I thought that one was funny. And then also the one that was pretty funny is when it's Arya and Sansa at the table and she's jabbing the knife at the table. And Sansa's like, what are you doing? And what are you practicing for? And Arya goes, I'm practicing for the prince. That had me bawling, man. I was like, get it, yes.
Arya really.
And then Ned's response to the lady, war is easier than the daughters. I really like that one. And then the most impactful line in this episode to me was what I said earlier, is Arya telling Ned, how can you let her marry someone like that? To me, that's like,
yeah. Arya's a different kind of kid. Like, I usually don't like smart kids on shows. Like, kids who seem like they're smarter than every adult. But she's definitely one of those kids. So my two quotes kind of go together. So the first one, Cersei says to Joffrey, a good king knows when to save his strength and when to destroy his enemies. And the other one was Lord Baelish, the Starks, quick tempers, slow minds. And I thought that was really cool, especially with Ned telling Catelyn to control her temper, because like Catelyn is a Stark versus Cersei, who married a Baratheon, but she's a Lannister. And it's sort of like more of the difference between the two of them.
Yeah, Catelyn kind of adopted her husband's values and views and everything, where Cersei, like, she's her father's kid. Like, she is Tywin Lannister. She's a Lannister through and through.
Absolutely. So, that's going to do it for this week on Charge It to the Game, a Game of Thrones rewatch podcast. We will see you guys next week. And now our watch is ended.